Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Kambiz Ganabasiri, professor of religious studies at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and author of A History of Islam in America. He'll speak on the topic, Can American Muslims Define a Multicultural America? This program, co-sponsored by UNO International Studies and Programs, as well as the Departments of Religious Studies, History, and Political Science, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, November 13, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Ramazan Kalinch, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Today we are lucky to have Dr. Kambiz Ganabasiri, and it took several emails back and forth to have him here to find the time that works for both of us, but I'm glad that finally he's here with us. In February, we will have another event, as some of you might have known already. This is part of a two-lecture discussion series on American Muslims. Today, Dr. Ganabasiri will be talking more about American Muslims in general, and in February, we will have another speaker, Dr. Edward Curtis, and he will be talking about African-American Muslims. And the title of his talk is The Black American Contributions to U.S. History and Culture. So please mark your calendars for February 11th. It is not a Friday evening. It's a Thursday evening. Okay. So again, we will be here in Community Engagement Center, the other rooms, at 6:30 again, the same time. And before I present Dr. Ganabasiri, let me credit those who helped us along the process in making tonight possible. First of all, I would like to thank the Humanities Nebraska for their generous support for our program, which made this event possible. Second, I want to thank our student supporters from Sustained Dialogue. Actually, they helped us in putting the program together, and more importantly tonight, they will help us facilitating some discussions after we hear Dr. Ganabasiri's talk. I also want to thank the steering committee of committee members of the Islamic Studies program for their help in all the process, particularly Dr. Patrick McNamara and Christian Peterson. Having a dialogue of this sort was first Patrick's idea, and he also helped getting the grant and having these programs possible. So thank you so much for doing that. And Christian helped us in identifying the speakers, putting everything together as well. So I'm really thankful to both of you. And I want to acknowledge our campus partners, International Studies and Programs, Religious Studies Department, History Department, and Political Science Department for co-sponsoring this program. And I also want to thank our student organizations, Muslim Student Association, Arab Student Association, and Afghan Student Association for publicizing the event widely on campus. They did a good job, as you see. But I don't want to take more of your time. Simply, let me say I also thank others who helped us in putting this program together. Now I want to present our speaker, Dr. Kambiz Ganabasiri. Dr. Ganabasiri is a professor of religious studies at Reed College, a very prestigious liberal arts college, and he is one of the leading scholars on American Muslims. He did his PhD at a university called Harvard University. I heard that it's a good one in the United States, but his academic focus is on Islamic social and intellectual history in the classical and modern periods, Islam in the United States, and religious diversity in U.S. history. He is the author of arguably the best book on the history of American Muslims, which is published by Cambridge University Press a few years ago. As someone who read his book, I also want to say a few words about it. In the words of our next speaker, this is also an advertisement of our next speaker, who will come to Omaha in February, this book is the most comprehensive historical monograph yet written about Islam in the United States. The book demonstrates the complexity and diversity of American Muslim experience, which we will hear from our speaker again tonight, and the richly documented and incredible analysis that Dr. Ganabasiri provides in his book powerfully challenge the stereotypes about Muslims that exclude them from American history. Tonight, the title of Dr. Ghanaba's series talk is Can American Muslims Define a Multicultural America? Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ghanaba Siri.
Thank you, Ramazan, so much for that introduction. You named too many people to thank, so I'm not going to be able to thank everybody, but I wanted to thank Dean McManera and Christian Peterson, who are people who I've met. I was also going to say, is anyone from the Nebraska Humanities here? No. I want to thank them, too, because I had had an opportunity to work with the National Humanities Association National Endowment for Humanities, and they do amazing work. It was one of the most rarest opportunities I had to work collaboratively with scholars in the humanities, because in the humanities we often don't do collaborative work to come up with a program that has led to greater discussion in other local humanities or state humanities centers on Muslims called the Muslim Journeys. I know there are libraries in Nebraska that are affiliated with that program, so if you have a chance to look up that program, Muslim Journeys, you should definitely do so. And if there are people here, I was going to thank them for the work that they do on behalf of the humanities. It's really an honor for me to be here. And thank you all for showing up on Friday night. I usually joke around whenever we have Friday evening events at Reed College to say, like, nowhere else can you get pack a room like we could at Reed, because we are so hardcore. And it's fantastic to see so many people here. A packed room for wonderful, dedicated folks who are here to listen to a talk on a Friday night. I just had a wonderful steak dinner, Omaha steak dinner, before the talk. So I'm going to try to do a good job so they bring me back. The title of my talk, Can American Muslims Define a Multicultural America, may seem a bit presumptive and premature to some of you, because while we have politicians and presidential candidates talking about whether or not Muslims can even become president of the United States, it seems kind of premature to say, can Muslims actually help define any aspect of America? Maybe the question we ought to be asking is not whether Muslims can define any aspect of America, but that, can Muslims actually fit into American society, or whether there's even enough room for them in American society. And people did ask that question, actually, a lot since the attacks of 9/11 in 2001. And part of my talk is going to try to explain why, actually, we're at a moment in American history where this question of whether or not can American Muslims define a multicultural America is a question that makes sense. I'm going to try to give you the historical background to this. And I'm going to focus mainly in the history of Muslims in America from the 1990s onward, but I'll give you a little bit of background on the earlier history of Muslims in America. Muslims have been part of the United States since colonial times, long before there were presidential candidates arguing whether or not Muslims can become American presidents. The founding fathers were debating whether or not a Muslim or a Hindu could become a president in America. That they were, when they were considering how robust this wall between church and state ought to be, one of the debates was whether or not an American president could be of Muslim background. And there were, of course, varying opinions on that. At the same time when these debates were going on, there were also Muslims who had been enslaved from North Africa and West Africa, who had come through the slave trade to the United States and were working in the United States. I'm sure Edward Carrigus in February will tell you more about this. Some of these were very learned Muslims, African Muslims who knew how to read and write. Some of them were religious scholars. And when people began to find out that among the enslaved Africans who were in America, antebellum America, they became really interested in the fact that there were actually black Africans who could read and write. And some of the abolitionists began to shame American Christians by saying, these people who you have for a very long time considered to be less than you could read and write, and as in the Islamic religion had recognized this and has educated them, while Christians have enslaved them. So they trotted out the histories of, and the stories, the biographies of these learned Muslims to be able to actually help the abolitionist movement. There are others who were involved with the colonization movement, that the movement to take African Americans and send them back to Liberia, to West Africa, to have them colonize Africa as a solution to the problem of slavery in America. And these people also became very excited to find out that there were African Muslims, who enslaved African Muslims, who could read and write, because they saw them as possibly folks that could be, serve as intermediaries between Americans and Africans to advance trade in Africa. I'm mentioning this to say that there's a long history of Muslims being present in America, and Muslims and Americans thinking, both with actual Muslims who were in America and thinking about Islam in their imaginations, debating whether or not Muslims can be a part of American society and American politics long before our present moment. So part of the subtext of what I was talking about is that Americans' national identity has for a very long time been defined, at least in certain segments of American society, in relationship to Islam or Muslims. In the beginning of the 20th century, when immigration from Europe, new immigration from Europe, particularly Southern Europe, had changed the demography of America, when slavery was abolished, and America was again at this moment of figuring out what its national identity would look like, there was a question of who could be considered a citizen. And people, immigrants who had come from Syria, Turkey, or Kurdistan, and the Arabian Peninsula, and when I say Syria, I mean greater Syria, so what includes today Israel, Palestinian territories, Syria, Lebanon, that region. To people who had immigrated in the late 19th century and early 20th century from these areas, there was a debate about whether or not they could actually be considered citizens in the United States, because they were neither white nor people of African descent. So there was a question of how do they fit in, because the citizenship laws at those times restricted citizenship to people who were either white or of African descent. And interestingly, a lot of these folks began to try to articulate themselves, define themselves as whites in order to be able to get citizenship in the United States or maintain their citizenship in the United States. So they argued that anyone who's from the land where Jesus was born should be able to be considered to be an American citizen. Later on, after World War II, when there was another huge shift, the watershed shift in the demography of America, and as people came back from the war, having fought for freedom abroad, there was a resurgence of civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s, as you know, in America, and people of color who had fought for freedom abroad came back home and said they weren't going to accept second-class citizenship in the United States, and they began to, at that time, again, participate. American Muslims were part of these folks who began to participate in shaping what an American national identity in the midst of this change would look like. So at that time, particularly under President Eisenhower, there was a move to think about American national identity, not in terms of ethnic identity, but much more in terms of religious identity, because the idea was that America is this sort of tripartite melting pot of Protestantism, Catholicism, and Judaism, and that people's ethnic differences, when they came to America, got melted away as they came to celebrate America and maintain their religious differences, perhaps, in terms of Protestantism, Catholicism, and Judaism, but didn't insist on themselves as Italians or Germans or Polish and so on. At that time when that was going on, there were American Muslims who were saying, wait a second, we're being left out, and they formed an organization called the Federal Islamic Association of America, and the FIA, with the idea to be able to say we should also be included in this narrative. And the people who were involved in this were veterans of World War II. One of them actually wrote to Eisenhower in order to be able to have the religion of Islam recognized on the military dog tags, so that when a veteran, an American Muslim, dies in war for America, they could receive proper burial because their dog tag would have an eye that would identify them as American. So this is in the 1950s. At the same time, while these were going on, events were going on. There were also some African Americans who found themselves, particularly African Americans, who had migrated from the South to the North, and in northern cities didn't find the opportunities that they expected to find, and still found traces of racism or experienced racism in the northern metropolitan areas, who began to see that themselves left out of the sort of prosperity that America underwent in the beginning of the 20th century or the first half of the 20th century. And some of these folks formed groups that you may be familiar with, like the Moorish Science Temple or the Nation of Islam, through which they came to define themselves as people who could participate in America's prosperity and America's modernity through Islam. So they came to say that those who are arguing for America as a nation that's Protestant and comes from a European stock and therefore is prosperous in the way it is are actually missing something, that there are those of us who are black whose religion is Islam who could use this same sort of black Islamic identity to define America in our own terms, define a sort of national identity in our own terms. And what's interesting is, despite the fact that they came to say that they're a separate nation from the rest of America, groups like the Nation of Islam, the values they adopted are American middle class values of sobriety, hard work, family values of monogamy, everything they taught was, you know, education, everything they taught were equivalent to sort of the values that white middle class America had adopted as a way of defining what it means to be American. So Islam also played this role in American history of defining a separate racial identity that could articulate itself in terms of American values, even though it saw itself as not being able to fit into America racially. So that's by way of background. Let me get to the part after the first Gulf War. And this is, I think, where really the story of how American Muslims can be in a position to define a multicultural America really begins. After the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet era, the end of the Soviet Empire, America found itself as the sole superpower in the world. And when it became the sole superpower in the world, immediately the first sort of challenge it had, where it had to act as the sole superpower in the world, brought it into contact with Muslims. Right? Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait, annexes it as part of his own Iraq's province, and the United States has to figure out how it's going to deal with this issue. And at that time, President Bush decided that this was going to be a new world order that was going to be represented by rule of law, and he was going to bring an international coalition to address this issue. Saddam Hussein, on the other hand, who was a Ba'athist, who, if anyone knows anything about the Ba'ath Party, was a socialist party, decides that he's going to start touting himself as a Muslim to create this sort of opposition between this new superpower and Muslims. So he adds the phrase Allahu Akbar, or God is greater, to his flag. He starts shooting Scud missiles towards Israel. He starts criticizing the Saudis, who were one of the allies of the United States in this war, to say that the Saudi government is actually doing a horrible job of protecting the holy sites of Muslims in Mecca and Medina by allowing Americans to come on its soil and so on. So he starts becoming like almost a Muslim advocate. And some people in American foreign policy circles saw this, most famously people like Samuel Huntington, whom some of you may be who posited this very famous thesis that there's a clash of civilization in this new world order. Now that the Cold War has ended and there's no longer a communist threat in the United States, that the next threat is going to be this sort of Islamic threat, because all foreign international relations are going to be dealt with not in terms of actually national interests and national politics, but in terms of cultural differences. And then so he saw that there's going to be a Western culture that's going to be posited against the Chinese and Islamic culture. And he pointed to the fact that Saddam Hussein had invaded another Muslim country, but was able to justify this by saying, by using Islamic reasons, that this pointed for him to the fact that there's this sort of cultural clash. Of course, there are, but you know, Saddam invaded a Muslim country, and there were most of the people who were in alliance with the United States that fought him were also against the, were also Muslims. He doesn't talk much about that. For American Muslims, what this meant was that they had to decide how they were going to interpret and understand what Saddam was doing, and how, especially since America had gone to war, you know, their country had gone to war with Saddam, and they had to decide how they were going to respond to this. And the response is actually pretty interesting, because what happened was that they were opposed to Saddam's invasion of Iraq. They were also opposed to the war against Saddam. They didn't think that people should go to war, and they also thought that Saddam was wrong. And so they were left to their own devices and had to decide, so what do they do, particularly since the Saudi government and the Kuwaiti government for years had supported a lot of American Muslim organizations in the United States. And when this Saddam had invaded Kuwait, and the Saudis wanted America's help to get Saddam out of Kuwait and to eliminate the threat he also posed to Saudi Arabia, they went to these Muslim organizations and they said, hey, we want the dividend on all that money we've been giving you to build Islamic centers and national organizations and things of that sort. And American Muslims were against this, so they stepped back, and they actually started saying, like, you know what? We need to stop accepting money from foreign governments, and we need to accept start relying on our own resources to build our own institutions and organizations. So even though, like, after 9/11, there was all this discussion about whether or not Saudi money was influencing American Muslims, American Muslims already in the 1990s had decided that money was tainted and had stopped taking it and had become a lot more self-reliant than they had been previous to the invasion of Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. There was another issue. This was the first time that the United States had gone to war with a Muslim-majority country, and it had actually Muslims in its army. And it had to decide what it was going to do. And it had questions about Muslims' loyalty, the Muslims who are in its army, to whom they were going to be loyal. There were actually American Muslim soldiers who wrote to ask for a fatwa or a religious opinion about whether or not they could engage in the war. And the response that they got was that if you're fighting injustice, that's okay. It doesn't matter who you're doing it on behalf of, that Islam justifies violence in terms of war when it's against some sort of injustice. The other thing these American Muslim soldiers realized was that, they actually are not very well organized, and they don't know who they are, and they're in the army. They didn't know what their numbers were, so they start actually organizing themselves, and the army itself begins to recognize them, to the point that in 1993, the army appoints a chaplain, a Muslim chaplain, to the Army Corps. So as a result of all of this, slowly the American government and American Muslims start grounding themselves and rooting themselves further into American society and American politics. Then we have the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, the first bombing of the World Trade Center, which also raised a lot of flags for people. That was the first time that American Muslims... So some of the people involved in the bombing were American Muslims. Some of them were people who, during the jihads or the war in Afghanistan, had participated with American support in the jihads against the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And after this bombing, there were also people who began to question, how do American Muslims fit into American body politic? Particularly at a time in the 1990s, where under this new world order, they were trying to create a America was trying to get beyond the culture wars of the 1960s and 70s to be able to create a multicultural identity at home. And this multicultural identity was first and foremost displayed in the public in the army itself. You may remember some of the images we got back from the 1990-91 Gulf War, that we would see soldiers who were Latinos, we would see soldiers who were African-American, we would see soldiers that were Asian, that we would see women soldiers and men soldiers, right? The American body politic was this multicultural politic that was on television in the form of the army being manifested throughout the nation. So there was this attempt to create this sort of multicultural body politic in the United States, at the time where America is at war with a Muslim majority nation. And then you have this bombing that occurs, and there are people who are beginning to say, like, we're doing such a good job, but where do Muslims fit in? Can we actually, given this bombing, can Muslims actually become part of this American body politic? Has anyone seen the film Siege? The Siege? No? You should see it. Denzel Washington's in it. Bruce Willis is in it. And this movie asks this question after the World Trade Center about can American Muslims fit into the American body politic? The story behind it is that there is pissed off Muslims in the United States who are pissed off by the fact that the United States did not support them after this war that's supposed to be the Iraqi war, despite the fact that the United States has promised to support them. This was supposed to be analogous to the United States saying that if Shiites rise up, we will support them in Iraq against Saddam, and then the U.S. left, didn't actually support their uprising against Saddam. And so they're in the United States, and they're pissed off, and they're blowing stuff up. And the U.S. is trying to figure out what to do with it. So one of the solutions that it comes up with, the Army comes up with, is that we're going to create a concentration camp in Brooklyn, and we're going to put them in the baseball stadium in Brooklyn. And, you know, the film shows all these Muslims being gathered up to be brought to this stadium. Meanwhile, there's this attorney who's arguing against this and the civil rights of these people being taken away. At the end, what we see is that the mastermind behind this thing was this American Muslim professor who no one suspected because he seemed so assimilated, but he was very upset. And not only that, he was the lover of the CIA agent who was investigating the whole thing. And what the film tries to show is that America can handle American Muslims, that our civil rights are strong, and when the army wants to create concentration camp, the lawyer and the law comes and stops them and fights against it. And it also shows Americans coming out, holding posters saying, you know, freedom from these concentration camp that you have created. But there are still these sort of unassimilable Muslims who exist that continue to be a problem to think about in the United States. So Muslims become sort of a sore spot in this sort of new multicultural body politic that's been created in the 1990s. Before I move on, I forgot to mention a slight fact that's good to keep in mind. So one of the questions that were being raised at the time, where there were questions being raised about American Muslims' loyalties during the first Gulf War, there was a survey done by USA Today that polled Arab Americans to gauge their support for the 1990-91 Gulf War. And it found that the Arab American Muslims were less likely than Arab American Christians to support the Gulf War. So 36% of American Arab Muslims were supporting the Gulf War, and 77% of the Arab American Christians were supporting the Gulf War, which raises this question for a lot of people that, maybe actually Islam could be a threat to the loyalty of American Muslims to the United States. But what's interesting about that statistic is that the same poll also asked people what they thought the backlash would have been against them. And 73% of Muslims believed, of the people who were surveyed, 73% of them believed that the backlash against Arab Americans would worsen after the war, as opposed to 43% of Christians. So you could see that this actually probably didn't have much to do with questions of loyalty as much as it did of how people thought how America's actions abroad would affect American Muslims' lives at home. that for American Muslims, these two were tied together, right? And so it wasn't really a foreign policy decision, perhaps, that they were thinking about, but actually, how is this going to affect me? And this also further pushed American Muslims into the public square to be able to say, to get them to actually start participating in political structures and civic structures and so on. And so throughout the 1990s, we see a lot of Islamic organizations, and I'm sure you have this also in Omaha, popping up, small ones that began to say, we want to create organizations by which we could actually speak on our own behalf to the public. We want to be able to come to city council and speak on our own behalf. We want to be able to go on the local news and speak on our own behalf. In Portland, where I am, there was a Muslim Education Trust that was established in 1994 to do this. But if you look at major cities throughout America, you'll find right in the middle of the 1990s, there were these organizations, American Muslim organizations that popped up that said, we're tired of people speaking on our behalf in the public. We want to actually start engaging the public more ourselves and began to represent ourselves. So they started creating interfaith ties. They started creating various types of political and civic ties. And if they hadn't, when 9/11 hit, the backlash against Muslims was going to be much worse than it had been. So throughout America, American Muslims have stories to tell about after 9/11. We were just talking about this actually earlier during dinner, that Christian ministers, Catholic priests, Jewish rabbis coming to mosques and saying, what do you need? What support do you need? There's a story that I like to repeat that one of the leaders of one of the Portland mosques always says that after 9/11, he never engaged in interfaith dialogue or anything of that. He wasn't one of those people who thought these things were necessary. He had just come as an immigrant to work for Intel, and he just wanted to make his money, live his family, do his business and go home. And then he said that after 9/11, the first Friday prayer they had, there was a guy parked outside the mosque in a pickup truck, in one of those pickup trucks that have gun racks in the back. And the guy was big, and they're worried about who this person may be. So a couple of them, who are like this high and tiny, gather up their courage and go up to him and say, like, hey, sir, can we help you? And the guy turns around and is like, no, I'm just here to make sure if anyone gives you any trouble that I could take care of them for you. And there are stories of that sort that all American Muslim organizations. There are also stories of bricks being thrown into stores and vandalism at mosques and other types of hate crime of that sort. But they also accompanied with people flooding voicemails and answering machines when there used to be such things as answering machines. Filled with people saying, you're here. Let us know if you need anything. We could come out to your support. So after 9/11 hit, though, there was a huge difference where the backlash wasn't as great because in the 1990s, American Muslims had further rooted themselves in their local communities and were able to have allies who could come and say, we see a distinction between those attacks and you as our neighbors. But there was also where American Islam comes to be actually on people's radar and attention. People began to say, like, oh, they're actually American Muslims here. What are they doing? And then start paying attention to these types of issues. And in that process, an attempt is also made by the government to define itself as not being, by the state, by defining itself as not being in war with Muslims. So American government begins to showcase the fact that there are Muslims who are living in America, that they're happy to say that America is not really at war with Muslims or Islam in its attempt to defeat al-Qaeda or to go into war in Afghanistan to get rid of the Taliban. Nonetheless, there's a sort of discourse that emerges that comes to see that that there's a us versus them, that American Muslims sort of have to prove themselves to be Americans. And this discourse was analyzed and discussed by a professor at Columbia University, Mahmoud Mamdani, who astutely noted, when President Bush went to distinguish, in the way of showing that we're not at war with Muslims, to distinguish between good Muslims and bad Muslims. From this point of view, bad Muslims were clearly responsible for terrorism, At the same time, the president seemed to assure Americans that good Muslims were anxious to clear their names and consciences of this horrible crime and would undoubtedly support us in the war against them. But this could not hide the central message, this is Mamdani talking, of such discourse. Unless proved to be good, every Muslim was presumed to be bad. All Muslims were now under obligation to prove their credentials by joining in a war against the bad Muslims. So in this attempt to be able to say that we recognize that there are bad Muslims who do terrorist attacks and that these good Muslims who are the Muslims that are American Muslims or Muslims that are at home, there are a variety of names given. People begin to say like, oh, Sufi Muslims have a mystical inclination are good Muslims and these other ones are bad. You know, Salafis are bad. And there were all sorts of discussions of this sort that were going on. The effect that that had on American Muslims was that it started putting the burden of defending Islam on every single American Muslim's shoulder, from the fifth grader to the heart surgeon, to the garbage collector, to the cab driver. Every single person thought that every interaction that they have has to somehow define themselves both like as good Muslims. And that is one of the things that when we talk about racialization, right? What we mean by that, right? Racialization is when you come to feel discrimination or your participation in the public sphere and public spaces being marked by your body, right? How you could participate, how you could come into spaces and things like that are become limited by through bodily restrictions. And we start beginning to slowly then see this sort of racialization of American Muslims, where people begin to feel uncomfortable having to represent themselves as, whether uncomfortable because they are Muslims and they feel like they might not be welcomed, or because they feel like they have to prove themselves to show that they're not one of those other types of Muslims. And all of this begins to also further push American Muslims into the public sphere. So while parents used to tell their kids, go to medical school or engineering school, they start saying like, hey, son, you want to be a lawyer? That's all right. Now, I had to fight like hell to be able to allow my parents to let me study religion, because as we were talking about this with Christian before, religion's a hobby, my dad would say. Like, what are you talking about? Like, religious studies, that's a hobby. Philosophy, that's a hobby. Like, you become a doctor and you do that on the side. Like, that's not a real degree, So they started saying that, like, oh, like, we have all these doctors and engineers, but we don't actually know how American legal system works as people are being deported or being detained and mosques are being surveyed and so on. So they began to say, oh, you want to be a journalist? That's okay. You could go be a journalist. You want to study religion? Go. Yeah, you could go study religion. And we'll pay for it, right? So they start coming into the public sphere more and more. And they start producing movies. Some of them become comedians, right? Some of them, they start producing all forms of culture. They start participating in civic life. They start running for office, right? We start getting our first American Muslims elected to Congress after 9/11. We have two Muslim congressmen right now in the U.S. Congress. We start seeing Muslims running for office in local elections and state elections and organizing. And not only that, being willing to pay for these things. And another thing that happens after 9/11 was that Muslim charities come under attack for sending money abroad to so-called terrorist organizations, and some of them closed down. And a lot of American Muslims who had to pay their zakat or alms that Muslims are obligated to pay or wanted to pay charity stopped giving their money to international organizations that they used to give to help things in Bosnia, Chechnya, Kashmir, Palestine, and so on. And they start funding local organizations. So all of a sudden, local Muslim organizations, you know, the people who are striving to do things locally, organize locally, get this infusion of money too. And they start participating, they start doing more activities, and they start broadening their scope of their activities to not just be limited to Muslims, but to civic engagement more generally, dealing with issues of racism, dealing with issues of poverty, and so on. Excuse me. And nonetheless, though, and you could tell me if I'm wrong, there's still this sense that remains that people, well, we want American Muslims in the army. We see American Muslims are participating in society. We want them to run for elections. We want them to be more involved in civic politics. But we're actually not sure about their loyalty. We're still going to be careful with them, and we're gonna have this anxiety, worry about the how well they actually fit in? And there's a question of where does that actually come from? And I think, am I right about this? Am I in the sense of that there's this concern, right? We want American Muslims to be involved, but you're not sure how they're going to be involved and whether we're going to actually like their involvement. You know? I'm seeing a lot of heads nodding. And so there's a question for me of where does this come from? Does this come from American Muslims? Does it come from Islam? Or does it come from something in American history? And I like to argue that it actually comes from something in American history. We've had two modes of assimilation in America over the years. We have had this mode that goes through religion, and we've had another mode that goes through race. Assimilation through religion, because of the First Amendment, has always allowed minorities and outgroups to celebrate America. And American Muslims did this too. So when we had the so-called Ground Zero Mosque controversy, American Muslims came on the national stage in their own voices, without any accent, say, you know, let me tell you what the First Amendment means, buddy. And this is what actually your constitution means. And what you're doing is actually un-American. So I'm going to tell you what America is actually about, right? It was the first time in the history of America and the history of American Muslims that they're on the national stage in their own voices defining America for Americans, saying the First Amendment actually gives us these rights and this is what religious freedom means. And other groups had done that before. Catholics did it when their schools came under attack. Similarly, Jews did it. Other groups had done similar types of things when they came under attack. And the First Amendment's always allowed people to organize, right? And by time they become noticed as an organization because of freedom of religion allowed people to actually build mosques and temples and so on and churches and be able to organize. And by time they've actually come to be noticed and become a political threat to some folks, they're actually established enough to fight back, because they've been able to organize. And American Muslims did that too. By the time the 2010 controversy around the Ground Zero Mosque comes along, we have Muslim civil rights organizations, we have wealthy Muslims who could actually mobilize and respond to these things. And we also had all sorts of engagement between Muslims and the media, Muslims, and various other types of organizations that could respond to these things. So it allows people to come and say, we're Americans, and we're proud to be Americans, and we're Jews, and we're Muslims, and we're Catholics because of the First Amendment. But if you're racially a racial minority group, you historically weren't able to celebrate the laws. The laws were your problem, right? The laws were the things that didn't let you drink from a fountain or buy a house in an area or before the abolition and slavery, not be enslaved, right? The laws were actually the problem. So it makes it very difficult to actually say, I'm going to celebrate America. And for American Muslims, because they're racially diverse, they're African-American Muslims, they're also black Muslims or African Muslims, and they're ethnically diverse, they're an enormously diverse group, and they're religiously a minority, they run into this problem of how do you assimilate in a society that has these two modes of assimilation. So from the racial perspective, what you had to do was be able to tell Americans, like, I'm not celebrating American laws or America. What I'm doing is holding it accountable to its ideals to denounce those laws, to say Jim Crow is wrong, racism is wrong, unfair wages is wrong, and things of that sort are wrong, unfair housing policies are wrong, and so on, right? It always meant holding America accountable. Assimilation through race meant learning how to hold America accountable to its ideals despite its practices. Assimilation through religion often meant celebrating American laws and American practices. American Muslims as a racially, ethnically diverse body and a religious minority are left now at this point of having to square that circle for the rest of America. And if they figure out actually how to be a multiracial, multi-ethnic body that can both hold accountable, both America, the state accountable, and celebrate America at the same time, they've sort of solved the solution, provided a way for America to be a multicultural country, right? For multicultural America to be defined. I'm not the only person who has noticed this. I'm talking too long, so I'm going to stop, but I'm going to let you know that the State Department has just in 2014 published a pamphlet called American Muslims, in which they precisely do this. They talk about how Muslims as a racially diverse community that has, despite this racial diversity, been able to use religion as a unifying force and is prosperous in America, right? Because there are all these Muslim entrepreneurs and Muslim physicians and, you know, Muslims in the American workforce who are prosperous, celebrates American Muslims as this thing that's possible in America, as a body that could be both racially diverse and religiously different to define what's possible in America, to define, to realize America's ideals. I'm going to stop there and let's go to discussion. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Kambiz Ganabashiri, professor of religious studies at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and author of A History of Islam in America. He spoke on the topic, Can American Muslims Define a Multicultural America? This program, co-sponsored by UNO International Studies and Programs, as well as the Departments of Religious Studies, History, and Political Science, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, November 13, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The next lecture in the series will take place this Thursday evening, February 11th at 6:30 in the UNO Barbara Weitz Community Engagement Center. The speaker will be Edward Curtis, professor of religious studies at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and author of Muslims in America, A Short History. He'll speak on the topic, Black Muslim Contributions to United States History and Culture. Special thanks to Ramazan Kalinch, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.